Committee on Judiciary. It's nice to see that the right hand of the dais all is present and accounted for. I don't know what happened to this side. Maybe their elevator broke down or something. We have a little bit of work to do before we move on to the informational meeting we're going to have this afternoon. But first, we're going to do a couple of measure introductions. You have in front of you LC 57-2, LC 1588-2. One is a burden of proof shifting in contested case civil proceedings, and LC 1588-2 is an issue involving justice courts. As is always the case with measure introductions for the committee, your support of the measure being introduced as a committee bill neither indicates support or opposition to the bill. So the chair would move the introduction of LC 57-2 be introduced as a committee bill. Is there any discussion? Any objection? Hearing none, the bill is introduced. Chair would move the introduction of LC 1588-2 at the request of the Oregon Justice of the Peace Association. Is there any discussion? Any objection? Hearing none, the bill is introduced. Next up, colleagues, I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 2409. 2409, you'll recall, we had on loan from the PERS Committee. And after the hearing that we had last, I guess it was Thursday, on this issue, there was an issue that was raised involving this time frame. You'll recall that there was a little tension in that discussion just about how that would operate, and I think that this amendment is designed to clarify that. Steve, do you want to come up just briefly and put yourself on the record, and then we'll talk just briefly about this amendment?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm Steve Rodman with PERS. There was, as you say, much discussion last Thursday about the window and how broad it is for other lawsuits that could also come in under the provisions of the bill as drafted. And we informed the chair that while there are no lawsuits pending, that the board, PERS board, is actually meeting tomorrow. And one of the agenda items is to adopt employer rates. And that may trigger another round of lawsuits once those rates are established. That was the basis for the Lipscomb lawsuit that's under discussion now. So that's why we suggested that that window may be broader than you intended. So we wanted you to be aware of those circumstances.
And the Dash 1 amendment is designed to address that by essentially inserting the January 1, 2003 date, which essentially says that the case would have needed to have been filed by that date. So it closes both the front end and the back end of the window, so we're targeting this entirely with the Lipscomb decision. So that's the impact of the Dash 1 amendment. Colleagues, as I described before, we can't amend this bill. We simply can make a recommendation to the PERS committee. But it would be the chair's intention at this point, if the committee is in agreement, that we would recommend the adoption of the Dash 1 amendment. And I will actually, I'll make a motion and we'll vote on that so everybody's comfortable. Are there any questions for Steve? Okay. Thanks, Steve.
Sure.
Jim, do you want to come forward? You'll recall also, colleagues, last Thursday, I put Jim on the spot as the attorney for the both the Supreme Court and the Court of Appeals by asking him to come up and comment on this bill before he had had a chance to talk to the Chief Justice. And so this is Jim's opportunity to get back to us on this issue.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Jim Nass, legal counsel for the courts. I haven't had a chance to talk to the Chief Justice, but I have had a chance to talk to the Chief Judge about the bill. And in concept, we have no problem with the bill in terms of it being a legislative decision whether to expedite these cases. Our concern is with the vehicle that's been chosen to do so. As the bill is written, it purports to compel both courts to decide a matter in front of the court in a certain way. Granted, it's only the issue of whether to certify, but those decisions traditionally have been discretionary with both with both forums. And the effect of this bill is to dictate to the court how that decision will be made in each court. It arguably raises a separation of powers issue, but also it's somewhat of a practical one in that historically these types of issues are made by both courts meeting with the meeting en banc, meaning all ten judges in the Court of Appeals will meet, and then an order will issue. So it's across the alley of the Supreme Court. Seven of them meet, and then an order issues. It would be a simpler and easier way simply to declare that jurisdiction of these appeals is transferred from the Court of Appeals to the Supreme Court. And I have put together some language that you will find on the flip side that I think will do that. So we would ask the committee to recommend these amendments to the bill.
Thank you, Jim. Are there questions for Mr. Nass?
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Carmel.
Just one, I think this is a quick question, but is the way that it's written now sort of saying that not only does it go direct to the Supreme Court, but it's directing the Supreme Court that they must hear the case?
Correct.
Okay.
And I want to make clear that we have no problem with being directed to hear the case. It's the concern about being directed how to decide a motion to certify.
Mm-hmm.
That's a very narrow. It is
legitimate concern, and one of my concerns initially about how the bill was drafted. So I'm glad to hear that mm-hmm. it's sort of come out. I think that it does make more sense to just say you'll take the appeal, and that the appeals are going to go right there, as opposed to telling the Court of Appeals what they have to do with respect to certification, which I think does get closer to the edge on separation of powers issues. Is there any thoughts on this? Yes, Representative Shadow.
No, I agree with that. I think this feels better to me in getting to the same point. I guess the only question I would have for Jim would be, I guess technically the Supreme Court has jurisdiction to decide an appeal through the regular course, that is, from the Court of Appeals and then to the... Do we need to clarify that this is direct jurisdiction? I mean, do we need a modifier in there somewhere to say this is going straight from the trial court, straight to the Supreme Court, and not stopping at the Court of Appeals in between?
Mr. Chair, Representative Shetterly, certainly if you wanted to add the word, perhaps the Supreme Court shall have exclusive jurisdiction, that would be fine. I think subsections A and B make that clear, but if you want to add that word, that would be fine.
Representative McPherson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Nass, and forgive me, other colleagues here who have been through this process before, but haven't there been direct jurisdiction efforts in the past that took appeals directly to the Supreme Court, and were they solved in the same way, or did they raise the same issue in the way they were drafted initially?
Mr. Chair, Representative McPherson, we may have acquiesced last session in bills that had language similar to this. It kind of came up late in the session, and we had other battles to fight, so this one wasn't worth fighting over. I don't know that any of those bills actually passed. The ones that did pass are similar to the amendments that I offer, which is simply that the bill provided that the appeal will be filed in the Supreme Court. So there's no certification process. It simply goes directly from the Court of Appeals to the Supreme Court, from the Circuit Court.
Okay. Follow up?
Yes.
Good. There's some thought by those involved in the process that there may be legislation coming out of this session that would also... For which an expedited consideration by the Supreme Court would be appropriate. Is there anything about the possibility of having parallel efforts related to legislation that we're producing later in the session that would affect how we ought to act on this bill here?
We have had concerns in the past, both in terms of the number of bills that provided for some sort of direct review mechanism. Some of those provided that the case would be filed first and only in the highest court. Some provided that it would start in circuit court and come directly to our court. We had concerns about the sheer volume of those, because at some point, if all these bills pass, you'd just kind of be cutting the Court of Appeals in the normal trial and appellate court process. But not all of those bills passed, and not all of the cases that were filed that we feared might be filed. So at least coming out of last session, the burden wasn't overwhelming on the numbers of these cases that came directly to us. We would have a concern again this session if there were a great many of those bills, and it looked like there might be a great many of those kinds of cases filed. So I would hope that the legislature would pick and choose where it chose to use this direct review process.
Further follow-up, Mr. Chair?
Yes, Mr. Representative.
If in the course of crafting that legislation, that is, new legislation that impacts on issues that, for which we think expedited Supreme Court review is appropriate, if there were an attempt to include in that legislation requirements as to the consolidation of cases, is that something that the Judicial Department would have a view on, or is it a case of really having just refer to specific, like as we have here, to a particular lawsuit that we can narrowly identify, and is consolidation something that we have any impact on?
I believe some of the legislation in the past has authorized the court to consolidate if there were numbers of similar cases, and that's fine with that. That's something that the court would probably do on its own anyway, and we don't mind that it's in a bill so long as it's permissive and not a mandatory thing.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You're welcome. Okay, thank you, Jim.
Thank you.
Colleagues, I would move that we recommend to the PERS committee, with the forwarding of this bill having been reviewed by us, both the adoption of the January 1, 2003 date to close the window for these appeals, limiting it solely to the Lipscomb case, which is contained in the 2409-1 amendment, and refer to them conceptually, Jim's testimony, with a redraft of Section 1, noting that the Supreme Court shall have exclusive jurisdiction to decide an appeal taken from a judgment as defined in the bill as Jim provided it here. And I'll actually request that the amendment to contain that be drafted and presented with the bill to the PERS committee. Is there any objection? Well, let me ask this. Is there any discussion on that recommendation? That will be by letter to Chairman Canope of the PERS committee. Is there any discussion? Yes. Representative Ackerman.
And this is a legal question for which I do not know the answer, but can we vest exclusive jurisdiction in the Supreme Court? I recall a constitutional provision of that nature, and I don't know if it's exclusive or inclusive. I don't remember. Do you have any enlightenment?
I don't know that I know the answer to your question, Representative Ackerman. I know that if I say exclusive jurisdiction and I can't do it, legislative counsel will tell me. And then we may come back again for a discussion here in front of the committee. I know that the PERS committee is anxious to get this bill moving for all those reasons, so it's my desire to try to speed this process up and do this by letter. So the motion is, again, to essentially adopt or recommend adoption of the Dash 1 amendments, and then conceptually adopt the amendments put forward by the court, with the word exclusive being inserted between the words have and jurisdiction. And that will be the substance of my letter. And with that, Ann, why don't we go ahead and call the roll on the motion?
Representative Buckley?
Aye.
Representative Johnson?
Aye.
Representative Powell?
Aye.
Representative Hubbell?
Aye.
Representative Kozanski?
Aye.
Representative Shetterly?
Aye.
Vice Chair Anderson?
Aye.
Vice Chair Ackerman?
Aye.
Chair Williams?
Aye. So the motion passes, and we will close the work session on House Bill 2409. And apologize to our guest presenter, Mr. Latessa, who had to sit through something that he probably sounded like we were talking about another planet, didn't it? Yeah, we're happy to send with you our public employees retirement system if you'd like us to. Welcome, Mr. Latessa. Bill was probably going to do the introductions, but he's stepped out of the room. So, colleagues, it is our fortune, I think, here today to have Ed Latessa, who is going to be talking about promoting public safety through reducing recidivism, what works, what doesn't. And he is with the University of Cincinnati and a PhD in criminal justice. So thank you, Ed, and the time is now yours.
Thank you.
I tend to stay in when I talk and present. I want to thank you for giving me the opportunity to be here today. I was asked by the Department of Corrections to come and to address the legislators. I'm here through the National Institute of Corrections, which is a federal agency that is charged with promoting effective correctional practices around the country. And they put a lot of money into promoting this work. And so I'm pleased to be here today and talk to you a little bit about what we know, what the research has told us, and to answer any questions that you have. As I go through, feel free to interrupt me, and if not, I'll leave questions at the end. What I'd like to do in the time that I have is to briefly give you some idea of what this work has told us, and then to talk about what it translates into in terms of correctional practice and correctional programs. I'll make it clear that I'm not here to advocate for any particular policy or program, academic. I kind of let the data go where it takes us. But I think we know quite a bit about what the most effective strategies are for reducing recidivism rates among offenders. And we every chance we get, we like to talk about that work. The research that this is based on is really been going on around the world for a number of years. I want to make that clear that it's not my work. I'll talk about some studies that we've done, but this is really work that's been going on all over. I just read a study that was done in Europe that looked at correctional programs there, and they found in terms of effects the exact same things that we find in North America when we do similar studies. As I say here, the problem with research is you can find a study to support about anything you want. That's one of the challenges. You know, how do you know if it was well done? How do you know it's just not the one that they're showing you? To say if you believed every study, you wouldn't need anything. You just drink a lot of red wine. It's like getting an expert witness. If you don't like the expert witness, you go find another one. Well, the body of knowledge that's out there in corrections has been amassed over a long period of time. And a way to look at it is if I have 100 studies that are done on some correctional intervention of some type, there's 100 studies out there, 80 of them show no effect, and 5 of them show a slight effect, and the other 15 show negative effects. Now, then the question is, well, why would we move in that direction since the vast majority of the evidence indicates we're not going to get what we want out of it? And so that's kind of how this is all amassed. I'm going to skip through and just give you kind of an idea of what this research has told us when we look at kind of correctional programs. What we find is that on average that just punishing people, just giving them some correctional sanction of some type has actually a slightly negative effect on recidivism rates. When we do controlled studies, we don't see those programs as having much impact. Just putting somebody on probation, for example, the average effect size from that is zero. It neither increases nor decreases recidivism rates. Other programs actually slightly increase recidivism rates. On average, we see a slightly negative effect. When we looked at treatment programs, or what we'll call intervention programs, what we find is that there's a vast difference in those programs in terms of effect size. That most correctional programs, which by the way fall into this category, non-behavioral programs, have a slight effect on recidivism. A typical correctional program produces about a 7% effect size on average. That's a slight reduction in recidivism over control groups. On the other hand, what we call behavioral treatment programs on average reduce recidivism almost 30%. And just to give you some context of that, that would mean that if 50% of a control group failed, only 20% of the treatment group would fail. I'm showing you this for a couple of reasons. One is obviously you want your correctional programs to be on that side of the house. The other thing we know is this is an average effect size. Some programs are reducing recidivism 50 and 60%. My interest as a researcher was always in what was it about the programs that were most effective. I wanted to know, you know, why do some programs reduce recidivism and other programs have no effect at all? And so a lot of my work over the last 20 years has been devoted to that question. The second piece of the research that's important, I think, for people to understand is the research on risk factors. You know, why do some people break the law and continue to break the law? I mean, we have prisons, we have maximum security prisons, we have boot camps, day reporting centers, halfway houses, you name it, we've invented it. Some people just keep coming back for more. Right? They don't get it. And that's a very important question for corrections. It's important for a variety of reasons. One is, if we don't know what the major risk factors are, then we're going to kind of do what we think we ought to do with offenders. And this is a real problem in this country. The problem with corrections and crime is everybody has an opinion. I heard your little presentation there about whether to move something over to this court or that court. I have no opinion whatsoever. I don't have a clue what he was talking about, so I couldn't advise you on it. But I'll bet you when you tell people, somebody brings up the topic of crime, everybody tells you what you ought to do about the crime problem in Oregon and what you ought to do with offenders. I mean, everybody seems to have an opinion on that. I'll tell you a story. I was on a plane the other day going to Idaho, and I sat next to some woman who was one of these chatty types, and she wouldn't take a hint. And she asked me what I did for a living, and I made the mistake of telling her I was a criminologist. And for 4 hours, she told me how to solve the crime problem in America. So now I just tell them I'm a proctologist and they leave me alone.
That's a thought.
But this is where, I'm telling you this because I think this is where a lot of correctional programs get into trouble. They don't understand the research. I'm not going to walk you through all of it, but I just want to give you some idea of the magnitude, the number of studies, hundreds of studies that have looked at what risk factors are highly correlated with criminal conduct. And I'm going to cut through all that research and I'm going to tell you what those factors are. Okay? And these are what we call the major set of risk need factors. And the first four are the strongest. We call them the big four and the little two. Number one is antisocial, pro-criminal attitudes, values, beliefs, and cognitive emotional states. What we call in the business criminal thinking. We hear it in a variety of forms from people that get into trouble. Some of them have a set of values and attitudes that say it's okay to break the law. They don't accept responsibility. They blame others. They deny harm done to the victim. You know, after all, these people have a lot of money or they'll get a new car. They minimize the harm that they did. These are all a set of cognitive distortions that help people reinforce their behavior. If I don't think what I did was all that bad, if I think the person I did it to had it coming, then obviously my actions aren't that serious. Number two on the list of pro-criminal associates in isolation from anti-criminal others. We all know this. We have children. We know it. We worry about who they hang around with. Our parents worried about who we hung around with. It's a major risk factor. But it's not just having antisocial friends. Also not having pro-social associates. And that's a particular problem for people in prison, of course, because they're surrounded by antisocial people. And one of the strategies one has to develop is ways to reduce criminal associates and strengthen pro-social people. Third on the list are what we call temperament and personality factors. And these are often overlooked, but they play a major part in criminal conduct. Things like psychopathy, weak socialization, impulsivity, restless aggressive energy, egocentric, which is kind of the opposite of low self-esteem. It's kind of a myth that low self-esteem is highly correlated with criminal conduct. Just the opposite. Many offenders are pretty self-centered, especially higher-risk offenders. They don't suffer from low self-esteem, but rather they feel pretty good about themselves. Taste for risk and weak problem-solving and self-regulation skills. These are all areas, by the way, that can be, most of these areas can be targeted. It can reduce people's risk-taking behavior. It can reduce people's egocentrism and so forth. So I'm not only showing you risk factors, I'm showing you targets for change. Now, I should point out with personality that personality is most likely working with other risk factors. Being egocentric will not make you a high-risk offender. We'd have to lock up all the judges and professors in this country if that were the case. Right? Probably a few lawyers to boot.
Well, let's not forget legislators.
Yeah, I don't know about it. But when you have people with antisocial personalities and antisocial friends and antisocial thinking, they tend to become extremely high risk for criminal conduct. The fourth on the list is one that we're all familiar with. That's a history of antisocial behavior. In many ways, this is the proxy for other risk factors. If you've got a long criminal record, you're surely hanging around with people that get in trouble, and you surely think like a criminal, and you probably have a host of other risk factors. The problem with history, though, it's a good predictor. It's a great predictor. But it has some weaknesses. One is that you can't change it. So if I was first arrested at age 10 or 12, I always have been first arrested at age 10 or 12. I can't get rid of that. If I have a prior felony, I always have a prior felony. So that's one of the problems with it. It's a good predictor, but it has limited utility often in programming. The second problem with history, of relying on history, is that you have to have it before it's a risk factor. I'll give you an example. I used to study habitual drunk drivers. And I'll let you in on a secret. It doesn't take a PhD to figure out that a guy with 5 DUIs has a drinking and driving problem and may do it again. It's high risk for that behavior. But here's the point I'm making is at one point he only had one DUI. He did not have a history, right? And yet, he probably had a number of risk factors, right, that were going to lead to 2, 3, 4, and 5. But because we didn't have a history yet, we often think, well, we're just going to give him this, you know, some drug education program and send him on his way. And in fact, by the time he's gotten the third or fourth, we've got a real problem on our hands if we've got somebody that drinks and drives all the time. Number 5 is family factors that include criminality, which is a good predictor, but again, you can't do much about it. You can't change it. But other factors in the family, including low levels of affection, caring and cohesiveness, poor parental supervision, and outright neglect and abuse. And finally, low levels of personal, educational, vocational, or financial achievement. When we take these 6 together, we see the strongest predictors, strongest correlates of criminal conduct. And if I could just digress for a minute, if you look at offenders who often don't fit the mold, you know, if you take, for example, Timothy McVeigh, you know, Timothy McVeigh who bombed the Oklahoma Federal Building, what were his risk factors? It wasn't wasn't an alcoholic or a drug addict. There's no indication he had a long history of abuse. He didn't have a criminal record. He served in the military, honorably discharged. Yet this is a man who went to the death chamber believing what he did was justified. And then if we look at the Enron boys or the WorldCom guys, I mean, listen to what they say. They say the same thing offenders say. Everybody did it, and I didn't know what was going on. And in California, they call that the some dude theory. You know, some dude told me I could use this car. Some dude told me, you know. Well, they're not quite the same language, but they do the same thing. This is, by the way, why history is so powerful. By age 12, 40% of later serious offenders have committed their first criminal act. And by age 14, 14% or 85% have committed their first criminal act. So you can see that right now criminology is really spending a lot of its energy looking at life course studies, trying to identify those factors associated with criminal conduct that start at a very young age. Because we know that for some people that start young, we call them kind of persistent offenders, they start young and they continue their careers for a long, long time. They're the ones we have the most to worry about in the long run. That's why history is so strong. I should tell you, by the way, that this research holds up across groups, across ethnic groups, and across gender. I don't want to go into detail, but when we look at men and women, this is from a maximum security prison, looking at men and women on a number of factors, employment, family, marital, substance abuse, associates, community functioning, emotional problems, and attitudes, we can see that they're very similar when men and women were assessed on these risk factors. And so that's important because what it really tells us is if we're going to design effective correctional programs, we've got to pay attention to the risk factors, the factors that are driving criminal behavior. All of this research has led to some principles. And it's these principles that I want to spend a little time in talking about with you because I think they have application for your deliberations, especially as you look hard at your budget and you look hard at decisions you have to make. And these principles really come through the data very strongly, starting with the risk principle. Risk principle says target those offenders with the higher probability of recidivating. In other words, don't put your resources into those individuals that don't have a high chance of getting in trouble again. For a variety of reasons. We used to think that you didn't want to put your money into those people because it was a waste of resources. Right? Why would I spend money on somebody who's pretty pro-social? But now we have some data that's actually some studies have been coming out for a couple of years now, and we have a big one I want to show you that's showing us that not only is it a waste of resources, but you're doing harm. You're increasing recidivism rates when you target lower risk people. And I don't mean now people who commit a relatively minor crime. You can commit a minor crime and be a high risk offender. Or you can commit a serious crime and be a low risk offender. I'm talking about those characteristics that I just showed you that are associated with risk. You are all low risk, even if you committed most of it. All right. Even if you committed a serious crime, most of you will be considered low-risk offenders. You have jobs, you have family, you hopefully don't abuse drugs and alcohol, you don't associate with criminals and so forth. That's what makes you low-risk. And, of course, if you didn't have a job and you did drink too much and you hung around with thugs and you thought what you were doing was okay, now your risk would be much higher. We just finished a study in Ohio that was designed. Ohio's a Community Corrections Act state, like Oregon is. We put a lot of money into community corrections. Over the years, we've developed probably the largest halfway house network in the country. And every year, these folks have been very effective at lobbying the legislature for more money in Ohio. And they've done it under the guise that they're reducing recidivism rates. Department of Corrections last year decided to put that to the test. And so they contracted with us to do a study to see how effective were these programs at actually reducing recidivism. I want to talk to you about this study because it really covers basically both ends of the system. The largest study ever done. We had 13,221 offenders in that study. 37 halfway houses and 15 community-based correctional facilities were included. We did a two-year follow-up of all offenders. So our follow-up period for reoffending was a two-year period. Recidivism included new arrests and incarceration in the state penal institution. Basically, we want to know how many of these folks came back. After a two-year period, how many of them came back into the system? Our experimental group, we had 3,700 offenders who were released from prison in 1999 and placed in one of the 37 halfway houses in Ohio. These were men and women who did time in a state institution and came out into a halfway house. We had 3,600 offenders who were directly sentenced to a community-based correctional facility. These were not men and women that went to prison. These were offenders who were direct sentenced by a judge to one of 15 facilities that the state of Ohio funds. These are treatment facilities. Offenders stay 6 months in these facilities. They're all felons. They're all felons. But we want you to see that we had people coming out of prison as well as people that didn't go to prison. Our comparison group were 5,800 offenders who went on to parole during the same time period, but who did not go into a program. We matched them. They were matched based on offense level, county of sentence. If they were sex offenders, we matched them to sex offenders. If they were parole violators, we matched them to parole violators. And here's the important point, which is when I show you the data. Each offender was given a risk score based on 14 items that predicted outcome. Okay? And so we went in, we created this risk instrument, and we gave everybody a score. So if I scored 80 on the risk instrument, and I went into a halfway house, they would match me with another offender who scored 80 on the risk instrument who did not go into the halfway house. What that allowed us to do was to compare low-risk offenders who were placed in a program to low-risk offenders that were not placed in a program. High-risk offenders that were placed in a program with high-risk offenders that were not placed in a program and so forth. I want to show you the data. This is the effect on incarceration for low-risk offenders. What you're seeing here, these are all the programs that were in the study. All the programs in the study. These negative numbers are showing you how much worse low-risk offenders that went into those programs did than low-risk offenders who did not go into the program. So this program on the end, low-risk offenders that were placed in this facility coming out of prison, this is a halfway house, had a 36% higher recidivism rate than low-risk offenders who came out of prison who did not go into the halfway house. You can see here, these are the few programs that actually reduced recidivism for low-risk offenders. The best they did was 9%. That's the best we could do with low-risk offenders, and there are only, about six or seven programs there. Next, we looked at what we call low-moderate risk offenders. These were people that scored a little higher. They had a higher chance of going to prison. It's about split here. It's about even. But again, I want you to see now, the best they could do with these offenders was 11% reduction in recidivism. That's the best they could get. And you can see here some programs increased recidivism 19, 23, 36%. So again, much stronger negative effects with low risk. Now we see the effect on moderate risk offenders. Moderate risk offenders, most of the programs had an effect. The best was 19%. By the way, there were 9 programs that didn't work with anybody. I mean, they basically increased recidivism with everyone. So those are programs that were not very well designed or operated, but they got the same amount of money from the state as everybody else did.
Ed, if I could just...
Yeah, go ahead.
So what you're saying is the nine programs that increased recidivism regardless of the offender rate...
Regardless of risk.
That you were better off with your control group that you just sent home.
That's right.
And were put into no program than to put them into the program.
Yes. You got lower recidivism rates. Because you got to understand, when you do a control study and you find significantly higher rates of whatever, you're basically attributing it to the intervention. Okay? And in a control study where we're controlling for risk, that's the best composite measure of outcome. You're basically saying, this program here, River City, increased recidivism by 28%. So if there were 100 offenders that in that program, 28 more failed than would have failed otherwise. And that's what that means.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Brzezinski.
I wonder if you could go back to that last slide, the low-risk offenders.
The low-moderate or the low?
I think it's that one there.
Yeah.
That was one that you're saying that... It had more of a negative effect on
no,
them.
Yeah, the low is the one. You can see that for the low risk, more program, almost every program, with a few exceptions, increased failure for lower risk effect. Putting them in programs is just not a very, as I said to the state of Ohio, it's one thing not to get an effect. It's another thing to spend $60 a day to increase recidivism rates for these people. These people were better served just getting straight supervision and going back to their lives.
Can you share with the committee what type of programs that they were attempting to use? Because, I mean, it sounds to me from that study there or your studies is that you're saying if they fit the criteria for low-risk offenders, bottom line is we shouldn't even consider any programs.
These are all what we would consider to be high-end programs. They're all residential.
Okay.
These offenders are there an average of 4 to 6 months. They're expensive to operate. They purport to do lots of programming. Low-risk offenders, by definition, are people that are pretty pro-social. And when you put them in, you have a negative effect for a couple of reasons. One is who you're putting them in with.
Right?
And the other is by putting them in these programs, you often disrupt what makes them pro-social.
Right?
Right? I mean, it'd be like if I handcuffed you all and took you out and put you in the best treatment program in Oregon right now, the best program that Department of Corrections runs for 6 months. Right? You think it would lower risk? You think, you know, I asked, put how many would lose their jobs? How many of you would have families have some difficulty? How many of you think your neighbors would have a welcome home from the correctional program when you got out?
And I just want to point out that that's sort of the same approach that the legislature has on all our personal lives. So there's a lot of comparison there, actually.
Now I want to show you, first, the most important is this is the effect on high-risk offenders. It's opposite of what I showed you with low-risk offenders. First of all, most of the programs are reducing recidivism. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 of them by over 20%. 3 of them by 30% or more. Let me give you a perspective of what 30% is. You think that is not a lot of people. There were 13,000 offenders in this stuff. And you know, what we said in Ohio is, if every program in Ohio could reduce recidivism by 30%, and all 13,000 offenders were higher risk offenders, what's 30% of 13,000? That's 4,000 offenders. Hell, that's half your prison population, almost, in this state. So when you start multiplying this out across the state, you're looking at some substantial savings. Here's where you see the risk principle. Here's where you see the risk principle here. In these programs on the end, you can see it clearly. Mahoning County, this program reduced recidivism for high-risk offenders by 32%. The same program, Mahoning County, increased the recidivism rate for low-risk offenders by 29%. So you have the same program that's having a hell of an effect with higher-risk offenders. It's actually increasing the failure rates for low-risk. The risk principle is, think of it as the who. What it's telling us is this who needs to be targeted. Another way to look at it is, I would say if half of the offenders that come out of Oregon's prison don't come back again, that's the half we're not worried about. Who are you worried about? The half that come back. They're the ones that pose the most risk to the public. They're the ones we spend most of our energies on. So that's the half that we want to focus on. Now, there's a percentage of them for whom we have no effective interventions. I should tell you that. There's a small percentage, about 10% of any prison population, are what we call high-risk psychopathic offenders. We found that in the Ohio study as well. There were a group of offenders that had a certain score, almost 100% failed. Those are offenders that we want to have strong risk management techniques. We want to monitor them. We catch them. We lock them up again. But for that rest of that percentage, the research indicates we can reduce their recidivism. The second principle is the who, is the what. And we call that the need principle. Target crime-producing needs. These are crime-producing needs, what we call criminogenic risk factors. That's an important word that's making its way into vocabulary corrections today. These are criminogenic risk factors: attitude, substance abuse, peer associations, deviant sexual behavior, and so forth. We call them criminogenic because they're highly correlated with criminal conduct. These are non-criminogenic risk factors. Things like anxiety, self-esteem, medical needs, creative ability, physical conditioning. I'll give you an example of one. I have a friend who's a prison psychologist in Idaho. And he had an inmate in the institution who had acute anxiety disorder. Couldn't even look you in the eye, break out in hives, very nervous. And so my friend decided he was going to reduce his anxiety because he thought that was one of his big problems. And so he worked with him, and sure enough, reduced his anxiety. Inmate got a job driving the mail truck between institutions. They have three prisons in the same area. One day he took off with the mail truck and escaped. They caught him a couple months later. They brought him back to the facility. He wanted to see the psychologist. And he said, "Doc," he said, "I really want to thank you." He said, "What are you talking about? You escaped." He said, "I know." He said, "But you helped me so much overcome my anxiety." He said, "Before, whenever I did crime, I was so damn nervous I could hardly stand." He said, "You helped me. Stealing that truck was a breeze." And it's a classic because he's targeting something that doesn't have much correlation with criminal conduct. You can also see on there things like creative abilities, physical conditioning, very low correlation. Now, let me show you some data. This is an important point. What this meta-analysis shows is programs that target at least 4 to 6 criminogenic needs are producing effect sizes of about 31%. Programs that target 1 to 3 more non-criminogenic needs basically have no effects. Let me tell you something about the Ohio programs. We went and we visited every program. We collected information about them. Every program in Ohio targeted substance abuse. That's a criminogenic risk factor. Every program in Ohio targeted work and employment. That's a criminogenic risk factor. Every program in Ohio targeted employment. That's a criminogenic risk factor. Some programs then went on and targeted criminal thinking, peer associations, and other criminogenic risk factors. But other programs did things like karaoke singing, art therapy, yoga, current events groups. What does that have to do with criminal conduct? Now look at the chart. The chart doesn't say 50-50. It says 4 to 6 more criminogenic risk factors versus non-criminogenic. So one of the things we found in the Ohio data was a lot of programs, they would do the things that they kind of were told to do, but then they would come up with all this other stuff, most of which had nothing to do with crime. And the problem is offenders don't really know the difference. They think they're in that yoga class, and that's really helping them. Well, unfortunately, it doesn't have much effect on criminal behavior.
And you think that, well, that's somebody else, but, you know, I can tell you, I know there's a lot of acupuncture going on. There used to be in this state for offenders, you know, to do a lot of acupuncture programs. You know, only person getting rich on that is the acupuncturist. But there's no evidence that that's going to have much effect. The third principle, this is the who, this is the what, and this is the how. And the how is the treatment principle. And basically the treatment principle says, use behavioral approaches where new skills and competencies are taught and reinforced. I want to show you some more data from the Ohio study, because before I do that, though, I do want to show you this. One of the things we did find in the Ohio data was that putting parole violators into these programs reduced recidivism rates regardless of risk level. They kind of overcame the risk principle. And so for Ohio now, Ohio has a couple of strategies they're developing. One is they're not going to put low and low moderate risk offenders into these programs. But they're also going to make sure that parole violators are put into these programs, because as you can see here, across the board and overall, they reduced recidivism about 12% when they put parole violators into these correctional programs rather than send them back to prison.
Ed, I want to stop you because I want to make sure I understand what you just said. So to the extent that they've got their low and their low to moderates, that they're not going to put into any program at all when they get out, except
they're not going to put them into those programs.
Into those
They'll
programs.
Go under straight supervision.
Okay, so,
and, you know,
but then if they violate their supervision and become a parole
then they're going
violator,
to put them in one of these programs.
Then they're going to put them in one of the
right,
programs.
Because this study showed that can have a good effect.
Okay.
So, and it's cheaper, obviously, than processing them back through the Department of Corrections.
So when we say no program, we're still talking about people who are under some amount of post-prison supervision when they get out.
That's right. And that would be of a good point, because we're really not saying don't do anything with low-risk offenders. We're saying don't do things that increase their risk level.
Right.
Guy comes out, he's pretty pro-social, he's got a place to live. Doesn't mean he doesn't need help getting a job.
Okay.
And we ought to help him get a job. But we shouldn't be putting them in a program with a bunch of high-risk offenders and doing the things that are going to disrupt what makes them pro-social. We looked at the Ohio data because the question came up is, what is it about the programs that weren't working? Was there something about these programs that were having a negative effect? And I don't just mean the risk principle now. I mean some programs, as I said, didn't work with anybody. And so I want to show you, because I think a lot of the treatment principle was in this. First thing we looked at was the relationship between the treatment model and treatment effect. Now, this is the Ohio data again. So this is looking at the actual change in recidivism. Programs that were classified as cognitive behavioral. Cognitive behavioral programs are basically programs that target specifically that distorted thinking, those antisocial attitudes and values that offenders have. They're very structured programs how they do that. On average, they had an 8% change in recidivism. Programs that had other models that were either 12-step, disease model, what else is on there, therapeutic community, eclectic, basically had no effect. It did not change recidivism at all for offenders. Well, we looked at the relationship between the proportion of criminogenic programming and treatment effect. Programs that targeted more than 25%, we were pretty generous here with our criteria, had a 5% reduction in recidivism. Programs that targeted less than 25% increased recidivism about 16%. That's a pretty big swing. That's a 21-point swing. Programs that varied the intervention according to risk. High risk got more services. 7% change. Programs that basically everybody got the same thing. We call them one size fits all. All programs basically had a
percent change. This is important because one of the attributes of a behavioral program is that you have to teach people new skills. You have to replace the skills of lying, cheating, stealing with pro-social alternatives. And one of the ways that you do that in a program is by role-playing and practicing. What we found was programs that were almost every session, there was some practice. We saw a 9% swing. Programs where occasionally the never, we saw only a 2% swing. We looked at mixed facilities. These are co-ed facilities. Zero effect. Single sex, 7%. We think it's just because they got their minds on something else when they're in co-ed facilities. They don't seem to engage very well in treatment. And finally, and this is a kind of an important one, I think, for researchers, is because, and other studies have found this as well, older programs show better effects than new programs. New programs, generally it takes a few years to kind of get things up and running. And so the research kind of confirmed that. Now, here's what we found when we started putting that together. First of all, the average treatment effect in Ohio was only 4%. When you put all 50 programs together, all together they only reduced recidivism by 4%. I'm not sure that's worth $100 million a year, whatever we're spending on these programs, probably more than that. But the lowest was a 41% increase in recidivism, and the highest was a 43% reduction in recidivism. That's a big swing between increasing recidivism by 41% and reducing recidivism. Well, let me show you those factors. When we put them together, programs that have what we call a termination rate in an acceptable range, that meant that about 75% of the offenders that went through the program actually completed it. Reduced recidivism 5%. If the program had been in operation for 3 years, that got them up to 10%. If the program was positive behavioral, that got them up to 18%. If the program, 25% of their services had criminogenic targets, 23%. If they role-played, 32%. And if they varied it by risk, 39%. So what I'm showing you here, the more the programs followed, had these characteristics, the more effective they became. We're now starting to look at a bunch of other things in these data to try to help Ohio know how much to train staff and so forth. But I think you see the point there in terms of effects. I want to talk a little bit about what doesn't work, what's not effective with effects. And since the Senate had to suffer through this, you will as well. But I got this from my friends in Oklahoma. I call this the dead horse parable. It says, Lakota wisdom says when you discover you're riding a dead horse, the best strategy is to dismount. That means you get off of the horse. But in corrections, we try other strategies, including the following. Buy a stronger whip. Change riders. Say things like, this is the way we've always ridden this horse. Appoint a committee to study the horse. This is my favorite because everybody does it. Arrange to visit other sites to see how they ride dead horses. Create a training session to increase our riding ability. Harness several dead horses together for increased speed. Declare no horse is too dead to beat. Provide additional funding to increase the horse's performance. Declare the horse is better, faster, and cheaper dead. Study alternative uses for dead horses and promote the dead horse to supervisory position. I want to show you some dead horses.
At least temporarily.
What's that?
At least interimly, right?
Show you some dead horses.
Ooh.
First thing, the research has told us.
He knows it was in fun.
risk management strategies that do not include interventions designed to focus on risk reduction are not very effective. That is, the things we do to manage offenders, and we're pretty good at that, actually. The problem is when we take away those strategies, oftentimes what happens is no effect or negative effect. This would include things like scared straight programs. You know, take these kids down to the county jail or the local prison and walk them through and have some big ugly thugs scare them and scream at them and yell at them, right? Well, guess what? All the studies show that it has negative effects. It actually increases recidivism rates in those studies. Here's a summary of these studies that just got published. 7 experimental studies of scared straight. Michigan, 26% increase in failure rate. Illinois, 5%. Virginia, 2%. Texas, 11%. There's the big one, New Jersey, Rahway. Right. We've all seen Columbo, you know, scared straight. 30% increase in recidivism rates for the kids that went through those programs. California, 1% increase. Not one study that's showing reductions in recidivism for these kind of scared straight programs. Shaming programs, intensive supervision, shock probation, electronic monitoring, boot camps. All studies have either shown slightly negative effects to fairly significant negative effects.
If I could add, I want to ask you about boot camps. We've got a boot camp in Oregon. What's the general sense? Have you looked at boot camps nationally?
Yeah, I've actually assessed about 6 or 8 boot camps, and we've done some studies. I will tell you right out that the research has not been kind to boot camps. There's really, I think, the empirical evidence, the conclusions that are coming out are that they are fairly, that they do have an effect on recidivism. They increase it. That's what most studies show. I'll show you some data, and I don't want to pick on them, but this was a study done recently in Texas by the state of Texas. And they looked at rearrest rates for offenders that they had placed in 1 of 4 different alternatives: boot camps, treatment centers, intermediate sanction facilities, and substance abuse treatment facilities. You can see here the boot camp not only did worse, they doubled the failure rate. Here's also what's interesting about that. When they control for risk, these are the boot camp offenders. This is a high risk. You can see here they were no higher risk than any of the other offenders that were placed in the programs. Here's a study out of Washington State that looked at different treatment programs, what they call multi-systemic therapy, functional family therapy. These are all, you're seeing the effect sizes, how much recidivism they reduce. Juvenile boot camps, on average, are increasing recidivism about 11%. And here's a review from the National Institute of Justice. This is the research arm of the Justice Department. And this is what they said doesn't work. Number one on the list were correctional boot camps using traditional military approaches. Here's why boot camps aren't effective, because I think that's the important question. They're very popular. The public loves them. I've been to a number of them, and I will tell you that in some ways I wish I could get the kind of the buy-in from the staff in other programs, because many of the boot camp staff really believe in what they're doing. They have to be. I mean, they get up 4 a.m. and they, you know, yell at people all day long. You got to be pretty committed to do that kind of stuff. But here's why they don't work. First of all, you're bonding criminals together. I mean, that's the model that you use in a military boot camp, right? You take a group of recruits, and you develop esprit de corps. You bring them together as a unit. We're not trying to do that with offenders. We call those gangs in Ohio. I don't know what you call them out here, but when we bond criminals together, we produce gangs. The second problem with boot camps is they target non-crime-producing needs. Physical conditioning, drill and ceremony, yes sir, no sir, is not correlated with criminal conduct. I was at a boot camp with recently, and I interviewed a bunch of offenders, and I asked one young man, I said, what do you think you got out of this program? He said, I'm in great physical condition. So now what, he'll run me down faster to steal my wallet? You know, interesting, I was at this boot camp, it was a co-ed boot camp, and really putting women in those models is extremely, extremely harmful, but I brought one young woman in. She was very articulate. Now, she's almost done with the program, and I'm interviewing. When I interview offenders in programs, I want to hear their thinking. And that's why I'm doing it. If you've gone through a good treatment, a good cognitive program, I'm going to hear certain things. This young woman came in, and I said to her, why are you here? What's your risk factor? She said, I had to pay my mortgage. I said, funny thing, I got to pay my mortgage, too. And she said, okay, but you're better educated than I am. I said, yeah, but I wasn't always educated. I said, my father quit school in the ninth grade. He didn't end up in prison. So then she looked at me and she said, maybe you're right. I just wanted to make money the quick, fast way. I said, we're getting closer now. So I looked at her and I said, you must have had a lot of friends involved in criminal activity. She said, no, I only hung around with good people. I said, funny thing, she was a drug trafficker, you should know. I said, funny thing about drug traffickers, my experience is that they either have to buy from or sell to other people in the drug business. She said, I didn't hang around. I only hung around with good people. I said, where'd you learn the drug business? She said, my boyfriend. I said, where's he at now? She said, he's in prison. Now, my point of all that was not to argue with her, but you're listening to an offender who's got all of these defense mechanisms. Right? Now, she's going to come out of that program, that boot camp, right? And if her excuse is, I have to pay my mortgage, and I really don't hang around with bad people, right? It ain't going to be long before she's back again. Right? I knew immediately this is a program not targeting the things that got them. The third problem with boot camps is they often mix low, medium, high-risk offenders together. And finally, in my opinion, this is the most damning reason not to run boot camps, especially for young, impressionable offenders. What the social learning model in a boot camp is doing is teaching them aggressive behavior. Think about it. They get off the bus and somebody bigger, stronger, and tougher than them gets in their face and says, I'm going to straighten your ass out. And you know what? These are antisocial people. You know what they figure out? If you want to get somebody to do what you want, you just get in their face. And we've got studies that show that. We did a study in Ohio. We had a juvenile boot camp. One out of four kids that came out got their new felony was for a violent crime. And these were kids that were fairly low risk going in the door. And what we found was it was much lower to other programs. So, our conclusion is when you run these kind of programs, you're not going to, don't expect reductions. Now, there have been some studies of boot camps that have shown no effect, but they are programs in which there's at least 3 hours of treatment a day, and there is very structured aftercare. And in defense, and let me say this for those of you that think that the military model is appropriate. First of all, the military doesn't want felons anymore because their own research showed that if you had a criminal record coming in, you were less likely to do well in the military. And the military does structured social learning better than any organization. When you come through a boot camp, you get a job. You get a sergeant in charge of a unit. You get a place to live. If you do well, you get promoted. If you don't, you get reprimanded. We toughen these people up, and we send them back home. So the social learning model is not emulated very well in boot camps.
Representative Brzezinski.
I was going to follow up on the boot camps.
Yes.
The one study you had up there from Texas showed that it was reviewed after 2 years. Are the other studies you've reviewed about the same length?
They all vary. Typically, with recidivism studies, you study them as long as you can. Most studies, what we see is you'll get about 85% of your failures in a 3-year follow-up.
Okay.
you get about 70% in a two-year follow-up, with two exceptions to that, sex offenders and drunk drivers. If you're going to study those two groups, you have to follow them a long time because the odds of getting caught are so low. And so with most offenders, recidivism lines kind of peak at 2 years and start to come down. But those two groups, they keep growing for a while. In the Ohio study, we did 2 years because that's what the state dictated. So that was their sense. I'm real skeptical of programs where they're getting into a year, kind of six-month follow-ups. They're really not. Mm-hmm. You're not going to learn anything, a whole lot. It's not just these what we call punishing smarter programs that don't work well. A lot of things we do in the name of treatment doesn't work very well either. Drug prevention focused on fear and other emotional appeals. Drug education programs, basically no evidence that they have much effect. They form the backbone of a lot of drug programs in this country. I was at a penitentiary recently. They spent 6 months in drug education. Every inmate I interviewed told me they'd been through it 2-3 times before, and they could all teach the class. And so when I sat down with the warden and his staff, I said, why are you doing this? I mean, why are you doing drug education when all the inmates say they could run the groups? And their answer was, well, we're motivating them, or we're this, and we're that. And I said, why don't you replace it with a structured cognitive behavioral substance abuse program? You know, I can recommend two or three that are out there. So in the same time you're delivering an ineffective program, you could deliver one that has been shown to have some effect. Also, what we call client-centered approaches. And this doesn't really affect you much, but we really find it, the best programs are very directive. You know, you go into a group with, this is what we're going to target tonight. We're going to target your impulsivity. We're going to work on that. We're going to practice it. We're going to rehearse your risk situations. Not a non-directive group is where we go in and we say, well, what do you want to talk about tonight? Anything on your mind? And offenders love those kind of groups, by the way, because they're able to avoid the things that get them there. Someone told me in a group one day, we don't like to do role plays because the offenders don't like to do it. And I thought, well, of course they don't like to do it, right? Because they might have to demonstrate that their behavior there. And so I always say if they like it too much, it's probably not working that way.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Przanski.
Before we get away from the drug stuff, you made a comment earlier about the acupuncture not working.
Yeah.
I know that there have been programs to work for substance abuse where they've used acupuncture in that area. Do you have any comment on those type of programs?
Yeah. I actually did the studies. I did some of those studies myself. We had a big program in Ohio, a drug program that included acupuncture. They did the typical things, and they hired an acupuncturist and all the offenders that would come in every morning and get the needles and so forth. And they called me one day and said, we want to know if acupuncture is working. And so we set up a design, what we call an experimental design. All of the offenders, we had three groups. We had a treatment group, which got the acupuncture. We had a control group, which did not get the acupuncture, and we had a placebo group. They got the needles in the wrong spot. Mm-hmm. Only the acupuncturist and the secretary knew who were in the placebo group and the acupuncture group. This is the outcome data, by the way, that we published this study. You can see here, the control group did better, by the way. They had the highest, they had the lowest failure rate. The acupuncturist group did the worst. And that's a true experimental design, random assignment. I know they were doing it for a while up in Portland. At one point, they had 12 acupuncturists, I think, going on. I'm not sure they're doing that many anymore. Do you know?
They're still living in Washington County.
Are they? Yeah. And I know D.C., they still do a little bit of it. You know, all I can say is I have no vested interest in acupuncture. If it worked great, I think we'd have acupuncture booths all over the country. It might work for other things. But there's no empirical evidence that it's going to reduce drug use. among that population.
Okay.
Also on the list of things that don't work very well are what we call vague, unstructured rehabilitation programs. Things like counseling for everyone. You know, if a program, when you ask a program, what do you do, and they say counseling, that's a generic term. You know, if you have five counselors, you got five different approaches. You know, good programs have a model, and they follow the model. That's very important. Life skills programs, case management, good relationship with offenders, and then, as I already mentioned, targeting non-crime-producing needs are not very effective. One of the most important aspects of good programs, I think, is how they're designed. And I'm not a theoretician. I'm a kind of a number cruncher. But I've learned over the years that you've really got to have programs that are based on some on a model, based on some evidence out there that it works. You know, it would be like if you had a heart condition and you went to the doctor and he said, I don't know anything about heart conditions, but I got some ideas. I got them from my neighbor. Okay? I mean, most of us would go to another doctor. Right? You want to go to a doctor who bases your treatment on research and evidence. Okay? I want to show you some of the theories that I've come across in by looking at programs. These are not good theories, right? But these are the most common theories that I've come across when I look at programs. The been there, done that theory. You know, that goes something like this. I don't need no stinking research to tell me what works. I know what works. Right? I got 20 years experience. Well, that doesn't translate into programming very well. You can't train people on the been there, done that theory. Right? You've got to train them on a model. Offenders lack creativity theory. Okay? A lot of people subscribe to that. I did a program once for drug addicts in California. This wouldn't surprise you. It was for drug addicts, and it was what they call a therapeutic community. Offenders got up every day, and they did their chores, and then they had a morning meeting. And then they went into a room, and they did art therapy all day long. Drew pictures and stuff like that. I said to the woman that ran the program, I said, why are you doing this? She said, well, it reduces stress. And I said, you're correct, it does. You must have the most relaxed drug addict in the state of California. Mm-hmm. Stress is a trigger for drug use, but it's one tiny, tiny risk factor out of a whole set. Offenders need to get back to nature theory. You know, those are wilderness camps for kids. Send them up to the mountains of Oregon and let them, you know, forage and build their own little lean-tos and so forth. Again, those programs tend to bond delinquents together. They're not very effective at reducing recidivism. Offenders need to change their diet theory. That's a California one, too. This is one we just came across, a mental health program. And we couldn't figure out what they were trying to do, and they said, finally, we just want them to be happy. So we call that the happy theory offender program. And this one's my favorite. Offenders male need to get in touch with their feminine side theory. This was, I found, first came across this in a halfway house in New Jersey. And what they did was they dressed their male offenders up as women. Right? They had to wear wigs and dresses and dress in drag. Right? So you, just so you don't think I make this kind of stuff up. This, I just got this one the other day. Gardening conquers all. How to cut your jail recidivism rates by half by having them learn to garden. Now, this came out of San Francisco, too, so it shouldn't surprise me.
What are they growing?
Right?
Yeah, what are they growing? Yeah.
Also, that drum beating, that's a new one. I haven't made it over him yet. They have this drum beating thing that's above. You see, now it's both to relax you. These things all come out of the West Coast for some reason. I don't know. No. Some of them are up here, too. Let me just show you. This is why program integrity, what we find in the research. But this is a meta-analysis showing you the percentage change in recidivism when these things are present. Programs that have a specific treatment model, an effective model, like a cognitive behavioral model, on average reduce recidivism 22% Programs without a model, only 5% change. Trained workers, 23% versus 7. Supervised workers, heaven forbid we should supervise them, 33% versus 7. Printed manuals, treatment manuals, actually go in with a good manual on what they're going to target and how to do it. Monitor change in offender behavior, provide adequate dosage, higher risk it more, and programs that have an involved researcher, somebody that's studying them, shows these kind of effects. And these are some observations that I'd like to make before I'm finished. One is that the research is really not a fad. It's not going away. Academics are kind of funny breeds. We study and we learn things, and if people do it, fine, and if they don't, that's kind of fine too. But the research is really based on an overwhelming body of knowledge. I actually have colleagues who believe we don't need any more study, that the data cannot change. There's so many studies involved that you'd have to have, 1,000 programs that none of them worked for years in order to change the data. What works is not a program or an intervention. It's a set of principles based on empirical research. Risk principle, need principle, treatment principle are the three primary. Saying programs are cognitive behavioral doesn't make it so. Just because you start to adopt cognitive curriculums and cognitive programs in your institutions doesn't mean you have cognitive programs. There's a lot more to good programs than just following some manual. Make that point. And then I think one other observation is you need to develop strategies for bringing external providers into the What Works fold. And I'm talking mainly about mental health and substance abuse. Substance abuse, I think this state's a little bit ahead of the game there. You have a substance abuse agency who that have looked hard at cognitive behavioral approaches. That's not true in a lot of states. In my state, we're still a 12-step disease model approach that's not very effective with offenders. That self-help model doesn't work with this group of people. It was never designed for this group of people. It was designed for pro-social people like you that drank too much. It wasn't designed for anti-social offenders. And so it's important that the substance abuse and the mental health people are involved in this, because the fact of the matter is they're going to provide a lot of the intervention for offenders. You kind of can't ignore them. And this is what we know. Programs that meet the principles are more effective than those that don't. There is no panacea. There are no quick fix ways to fix offenders. Giving them a couple day shock treatment or running them around for a while, you won't get far. And the good news is, most research indicates that the most effective treatment programs are 3 to 9 months. Now, with some exceptions. The exception would be sex offenders. Need much longer treatment. But we don't have to do years and years of intervention to get these rates. We can do effective treatment fairly, if it's intense, fairly short time. Offender assessments, very important. You're not going to meet the risk principle. You're not going to meet the need principle unless your systems do good offender assessment. That's extremely important. If not, then they're just kind of guessing. Treatment's multifaceted. You can have a great treatment program. If you put the wrong people in, you won't get much effect. You can have a great treatment program and they put the right people in it, and the staff don't know how to do it, you won't get much effect. So there's lots of elements of good programs. And finally, as I said when we started, the evidence supports behavioral approaches. They're the most effective in the research. Questions? Happy to answer any questions you have.
Counsel?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Can you describe what a behavioral approach is?
I can do that.
Behavioral approaches, I have a better graph to show you behavioral approaches. Behavioral approaches tend to use cognitive behavioral or structured social learning models. Structured social learning are more likely to be found in residential programs or institutional programs because you can structure the environment. Social learning is basically the theory that says you are who you are because of how you've been raised and the people around you and so forth. You've modeled, you've learned that behavior. And so when I want to change your behavior, I've got to show you the appropriate way to behave and so forth. Behavioral treatment includes things like practice, role play, reinforcement strategies, what we call extinction. Extinction is where if you do an inappropriate behavior, I've got to respond immediately. If not, then it's like reinforcement. You know, if you make a joke about an ethnic group, and the joke's offensive, but I don't say anything to you, that's just like reinforcing. Mm-hmm. You think it's okay to tell that joke. Mm-hmm. If I say, you know what, that wasn't appropriate, Bill. Mm-hmm. You could offend people, and I know you didn't mean to do that. Right. Well, now what I've done is I've tried to extinguish that behavior. So with an offender in treatment, it's very important that you do that, because if not, they reinforce themselves all the time. So behavioral strategies are where if I want to change a specific behavior you have, you know, let's say you smoke, that would be the behavior. That's my target. Okay. I'm not going to change whether you smoke or not by targeting your self-esteem. I'm going to target your smoking. That's the behavior. How would I do it? Well, through this process. Right. So we develop a plan. When you smoke, you know, I say, Bill, you know, you can't smoke. This is why. Boom, boom. We talk. You know, you would start to learn the benefits of not smoking. You'd reinforce yourself when you didn't smoke. Now, if that didn't work, we'd do some aversion therapy. I'd shock the hell out of you every time you smoke. That would work too, but the minute I'd take it away, you'd go back and smoke it again. That's the problem with punishers. You've got to have reinforcers. So that's kind of a nutshell what a behavioral approach is. You identify the behavior, you target it, and then you use these kind of approaches. Modeling. You know, here's a good example. If I asked you to think of, you know, three speeches you've heard in your life that have changed who you are, I can assure you most of you couldn't do it. Well, if I asked you to name three people that shaped you, you probably could name, right? Parents, grandparents, uncle, mentor, minister, teacher. Well, that's really showing you how much more powerful social learning is than talking to us. Most of us don't learn much because people talk at us. That's not a very effective way. If I were trying to, I'm not here to, you know, change your behavior. I'm just here to give you some information. But if I want to teach you a new skill, what would I do? Demonstrate the skill to you. I'd have you practice. If you did it wrong, I'd stop you. I'd say, Bill, let me show you a different way to do it. All right? Then I'd make it more difficult. Think of it like coaching. That's what a good behavioral program is. It's like a coach. If I want to teach you how to throw a ball, I don't talk to you for 4 hours about that. I get you out and you throw the ball. If you throw it wrong, I say, I'm going to show you a different way, Bill. Once you've got the throwing down, now I say, you know what? Now I'm going to have you throw a curveball. That's a little tougher. Then I'm going to put a batter up there, right? Because, you know, you've got to learn to throw against the batter. So in other words, good behavioral programs use that kind of approach versus, let's talk about how to throw a baseball. So that's kind of the simple way to think of the difference.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Cummings.
Thank you. Now, if you would go just a little bit further and talk about cognitive behavior, because I understand what cognitive means and I understand behavior, but I'm having a hard time getting my arms around the cognitive behavioral model.
Okay. Good. Fair enough. These are kind of the principles of cognitive behavioral intervention. Is that thinking affects behavior. That antisocial, distorted, unproductive, irrational thinking causes that kind of behavior. Thinking can be influenced, and we can change and feel how we behave by changing what we think. Cognitive approaches, there's really three different elements to them. One is the cognitive restructuring, which is the thinking. right, which is the thinking. So let's say you've never had a job in your life. You think jobs, work is for other people, and you have no skills. Right? Well, using a cognitive approach, right, I'm not just going to target your thinking about jobs, right? Because let's say I do. Let's say I got you ready to go. You're excited. I'm ready to work. I understand why work's important, right? I thought through all the benefits I can get from a job. Right? Problem is, you still don't know which end of the shovel to use. Right? So that's where the skills come involved. Right? The behavioral strategies are where I'm going to reinforce and model that kind of behavior. So let's say I always say employment's a good example. I mean, it's a good example. A lot of programs think you just get them a job. Well, we're getting people jobs who don't last 2 days at work. They don't understand you can't show up late. And, I have offenders tell me all the time, I quit that stinking job. And I'll say, well, why? Well, you know why? That boss wanted me to sweep the floor. I said, imagine that, Why don't you sweep the floor? I wouldn't sweeping no stinking floor. And let the other guy sweep the floor. Well, you're no surprise they lost, they didn't keep a job. Okay? Here, cognitive, you start, but it's not enough. You got to have the skills as well. So a cognitive behavioral program is one where you try to first break down or restructure their thinking. And then after that, right, they start to practice, they start to play it out. You start to teach them alternatives to their behavior. Right? I mean, you go into a bar, somebody spills a drink on you, what do? You hit them on the head with a beer bottle, don't you? Well, of course you don't. Right?
What everybody does.
Well, that's what everybody does. Of course you say you're sorry, you buy them another drink, because you have other problem-solving skills. Offenders often have this, what we call linear thinking, very straight ahead. But what you have to do there is you have to play that out for them. Let's practice that here. What happens when you go out and we show you how you do it? What happened when you got the last time you got into trouble? Well, your buddies came over and they had a case of beer and you started drinking and so you start teaching them how to be assertive without being passive or passive aggressive. And so it's a cognitive process where you start getting them to think about and then they start doing thinking reports. They start writing out how they felt. A lot of offenders, a lot of people for that matter, don't distinguish between a thought and a feeling. And so you start to teach them the difference between a thought and a feeling. And pretty soon, if they're participating, a lot of them start to get it a little bit. It's amazing how I go to programs, I'll go all over the country and I go to programs, and I will tell you this, when I interview inmates and they've gone to a cognitive program, almost to a person they'll say to me, no one's ever challenged my thinking before. My whole life I did whatever I wanted to do. Got away with it. And you really go after that kind of, those entrenched attitudes that they've developed over time and start to break them down. One about employment. When my oldest daughter turned 16, she wanted to drive. She wanted to get a car. And I said, Amy, you need to go get a job. And she said, work? It was a bad four-letter word. And I said, yeah, you need to go get a job. So Amy got a job up at the local bakery after school selling donuts and bread and stuff like that. I have four kids, and I take the little ones up, and we'd stand outside and watch Amy cleaning the glass inside. Right? And the little ones would say, Dad, why are we watching Amy work? And I'd say, because I'm enjoying this. Now here's my point. I want you to think back when you were 16 years old and you got a job. Right? The clock never moved. Right? You couldn't wait to get off to work, right? I mean, all you thought about was the few bucks you made and you went out with your friends, right? Now, most of you view work differently. Most of you love what you do. I mean, you wouldn't be in the legislature if you didn't think this was giving back and so forth. I mean, who needs this, right? But, most of us now, we don't know where the time went, right? It's time to go home. Well, what's changed? Cognitive. Now, here's my point about my daughter. My daughter's working for $6 an hour. That's all she cared about. But I wanted her to get a job because I wanted her to start to develop some appropriate attitudes about work. I knew the women that worked in the bakery watched out for these teenage girls. I knew the girls she worked with. I knew that if she was late, they reprimanded her. I knew if they said clean the glass, she cleaned the glass. Now, more importantly, I got three other kids. My second daughter is now 16, and Jennifer said to me the other day, Dad, I want to drive. I want to get my license. I need to get a job. Now, what if I would have gave Amy $50 a week instead of making her work? What do you think Jennifer would have said to me?
She'd want $100 a week.
Yeah, $100 now, right? Inflation, right? Plus, I wanted, Amy was the oldest, I wanted her to model for the young kids that they looked up. My point is, I knew that she wasn't going to be a donut girl the rest of her life. That's not the skill I'm trying to teach her. I'm trying to affect right up here, cognitively. I knew she'd have up a job, she'd get an education, but I wanted her to come into work and understand that, you know what, sometimes you clean the glass. Sometimes you sweep the floor. Sometimes you do stuff you don't want to do. Right? Because you want to earn that money to be able to drive a car. And so that's why I went about targeting it that way. So, you know, those are just things that cognitively we often don't think about. We throw programs at offenders without really recognizing this kind of antisocial thinking that's hidden behind it. And we don't get very far.
And we have spent a fair amount of time in the Interim Judiciary Committee and through the beginning of this session taking breaks throughout the weeks to have programs that are trying to make us think a little bit bigger picture. And we want to do what works. We want to spend money on what works. We don't want to do what doesn't work. We certainly don't want to do programs that increase someone's recidivism.
Yeah.
That's the last thing we want to do. How do we get from here to there? How do we get from where we're at right now, where we don't necessarily feel like we've got a handle?
Yeah.
We're at a tough budget crisis.
Yeah.
This committee at some point is going to be put in a position of having to make a number of policy choices about, you know, what to recommend for the money spending committees on what to do and what not to do.
Yeah.
You know, what ought we be doing to get ourselves from the point we're at to the point where we know the things we're spending money on actually work?
Yeah, and let me say, I don't think you can legislate, kind of programming. I think if you might set some guidelines or you might give some direction to folks like the Department of Corrections and the others. But I think, you know, let's face it, you've got a lot of things on your plate. You can't worry about how many hours a guy spends in some program or even dictate that. In the short run, and I say short run because I'm sure if we came in Oregon and did a study like we did in Ohio, we'd find the same. We'd find some programs that aren't working very well and some programs that are. Until you have that data, you're not going to be able to say this program's increasing recidivism with any basis in fact like Ohio is. But I do think there are things you can do. One is, I think you could start to assess programs around these criteria. A number of states, and I'll give you an example of one because I think it's really one that nobody would confuse with correctional innovation. A few years ago, we started doing some work in the state of Oklahoma. And what I'm showing you here is we went in and we actually did the first round of assessments. We assessed a whole bunch of programs that were being funded by the state. And what we found was that 48% were unsatisfactory. We score them. We have a report card. Like you score your schools, we score correctional programs on criteria. 43% needed improvement, and only 9% were satisfactory. 2 years later, what they did was, by the way, they basically imposed a set of standards that says if you don't score satisfactory or higher, you're no longer a program in the state of Oklahoma. We're not going to fund you. Second time they went in and assessed them, you can see here only 5% of the programs were unsatisfactory, 50% needed improvement, and 44% were satisfactory. This last spring, they went through a reassessment phase. Now you see they have no unsatisfactory programs in Oklahoma. They've either improved them or they've defunded them. About 23% still need improvement. These are programs, by the way, that right now are on a chopping block. 46% are satisfactory, and 31% are very satisfactory. And just so you know, this is the national data. This is 258 programs across the country, including two here in Oregon, by the way. Only 9% of the programs that I've looked at across the country are very satisfactory. So that's what Oklahoma has done. Idaho has just done the same thing. We just went into Idaho, and what we do is we train them on how to assess programs and so forth. But what we've really done is said, here's a set of criteria out there that programs ought to be adhering to. Is it unreasonable that a program has a good treatment model? Is it unreasonable that a program does good offender assessment? Is it unreasonable that the staff have a certain level of training? Is it unreasonable? I mean, these are the things we look at. And so those are some states. The other states that are doing this, Colorado's doing this. Iowa's doing it. There's a number of states that have been trained on this process to literally go in and assess programs.
Did they pass legislation to implement the standards, or was that done administratively?
Most have done it administratively. The one exception to that was Idaho, where they did pass legislation concerning offender assessment. They did mandate that not only Department of Corrections, but the drug courts in the state all use a standardized, validated risk assessment instrument, and they actually prescribe the instrument. So, and that's the only exception I know where it's legislatively been dictated. And in that case, I'm not sure it's a bad idea, because it forced everyone to adopt an instrument so that they could start looking across programs at offenders. And you know, to the argument you always get is, well, we're different than them, or our offenders are different. I mean, all
it's an apples to oranges comparison.
Yeah. Well, a good assessment tool standardizes that risk, because it's the best composite picture.
Okay.
So some have done that. Pennsylvania's kind of been wrestling with this a little bit. I was there recently, and I did a presentation at their Evan Institute of Politics. And, you know, the sense there is that the legislatures, they don't want to legislate models, you know, because, you know, not every model applies to every offender. For example, a cognitive behavioral model would be what you would use with sex offenders. You would not use a structured social learning model with that. But for other kind of offenders, you might have different approach. You could use a family-based model, for example. For offenders. You wouldn't use that with sex offenders. So they felt that they shouldn't get into legislating it, but they also felt that they should be giving some guidelines to, you know, to the department.
Right. Did I see your hand, Representative Brzezinski?
I was going to ask, that you said there are two programs that were from Oregon. You remember?
They were here in Salem.
You know,
they were jail-based substance abuse programs.
How'd they come down? Do you recall?
Yeah.
You could say that.
Well, we won't be sending anybody here to look at those programs anytime soon.
Okay.
But they were typical. I mean, there were some things they did that, you know, that I liked, but they were very typical kind of self-help, you know, programs that really weren't using a very effective model. But I'll say this, since that time, I know that they sent staff to the National Institute of Corrections to be trained, and I think they've made some changes, but it's been years since I was here. I'm trying to think if I looked at any other here in Oregon. I don't think I have.
Representative Cromwell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just curious. When we were a couple of weeks ago, we did a visitation as a committee to one of our youth facilities called McLaren.
Mm-hmm.
And in the violent offender group that we met with, there were three young men there, interestingly, all three young men, after they go through this program, then will go and spend, well, one of them won't, but one of them will spend probably another 20 years in the state pen, and the other one will spend probably another 40 years in the state pen.
Yeah.
But I'm just curious, because one of the things that they talked about is some of the things that you were talking about, confronting what they had done, actually role-playing, reenacting their crime, getting pictures of the crime scene, this whole thing. And I was curious, number one, if you have looked at other programs like that, and secondly, is it can a program like that work at the state penitentiary where you've got, you know, these old offenders that have been probably there forever and but may eventually someday get released out into the community?
Yeah.
And how effective could we expect something like that to be?
Yeah, very difficult. I mean, that's a, you know, you're looking at youthful offender programs. I've assessed a few. In fact, the National Institute of Corrections is going to have a video training in September for youthful offender programs because they're following this kind of work. It sounds like they're doing appropriate things. The problem is when you've got some young people that are going to be incarcerated for 20 or 30 years, there's not a whole lot you can do at this point other than help them make an adjustment into that adult system. They're basically going to grow up in a prison and everything that that means. It is more difficult to do effective treatment inside the walls than outside the walls for all the reasons you could imagine.
Mm-hmm.
It's an antisocial environment.
Sure.
You know, and even if those kids go through the best treatment program you could design, they're going to go from that program into a general population with all the reinforcements antisocial, where everything you're learning is not to cooperate with the correctional officials, not, you know, not to be a snitch, not to do this. So it's very difficult. Most institutional programs, the most effective institutional programs, number one, they're self-contained. They have separate units. And number two, the offender goes to those programs prior to coming back out on the street. When you take offenders, you do programming, and you shove them into a general population, your effects pretty much go away. Not to say we shouldn't be doing programming with those kids, but the fact of the matter is recidivism reduction at that point is way, way down the road.
Sure.
for those kids.
Representative Jensen, mm-hmm. And then Representative Anderson after that.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Bob, would you pull your mic over?
Excuse me, I have a question, I guess, about the observations that you began with in the Ohio program, and that is the high risk versus low risk groups. And it was my impression that these were commingled in the various and sundry programs around the state. Is that,
yes.
Was that correct?
That's correct. That these are all people that were sentenced by some judge and, you know, they were put together.
Okay.
That's correct.
Just a point of curiosity, was there or is there any temptation on anyone's part to stratify these groups in some of these programs so that we have a better assessment of low risk with just low risk?
Yeah, that's a very good point. In fact, good programs do that. Really good programs try to keep separate low risk and high risk. If I'm running a correctional program, I don't always decide who's coming into my program. That's a decision made by a judge or somebody else. And so I may get some low-risk people that I just assume not get, but I have no choice. Good programs keep them out of groups with higher-risk offenders.
Yeah.
Right? Most of these programs did. Some of them did, but most of them did. So, yeah, there are other strategies you can use.
Follow up. As a consequence of that, I guess I probably would have hypothesized the results that you found. One other question, if I could, Mr. Chairman. Did I see the DARE program in there as one that is a no-brainer?
Yeah.
Could you comment on that? That's some communities like mine, that's a sacred cow.
I know. In fact, I'd be happy to send you the studies. There's about six studies now, national studies done on DARE, basically finding that it does not reduce drug use and behavior among kids. Now, some argue that there are other reasons to do it, to get the police in the school and so forth. My sense is that if I want to reduce substance use among teenagers, which I think is important, I go about it in a different way rather than what they do is basically talking cure, scare the kids. And interesting, two of my kids went through, my oldest came home and said, "Oh, I love it, Dad. You know, they tell us all these war stories and show us the car they confiscated." You know, like now she's, you know, the minute she was 17, her mother wanted a breathalyzer. But my other daughter went through, Jennifer, who went through, a little more cynical. Jennifer came home and said, "Dad, I don't know if the DARE program works too well." And I said, "Why not, Jennifer?" She said, "Well, I can tell who's going to use drugs and drink by who they're hanging around." I said, "That's my girl." Mm-hmm. In other words, my sense is if you really want to make that program more effective, you identify the at-risk kids and you do some cognitive behavioral interventions with them, what teach them about who they're hanging around with, and so forth. It's a tough one. I mean, I've been berated by DARE people, you know, kind of grab me. In defense of DARE, they're trying to change a little bit. They're doing more role-playing, they're doing more practicing. I mean, they're paying attention a little bit, but I don't think they're going to hit the mark for a couple reasons. They're talking cure, the one size fits all. They put low, medium, high, everybody together. You know, here's the way I look at it. If you had a teenage kid that never used drugs or alcohol, would you want them in a group of kids that use drugs or alcohol? Why not? Maybe it would rub off on those high-risk kids.
Or it might
rub off. No, that's exactly right. And see, we run DARE programs and we're putting all these kids together without any knowledge of which ones are using drugs and alcohol. I wouldn't want my kid in that. Group, right? But we made some mistakes there with DARE, but that's a tough one because the feds have pumped a lot of money into it. And I think getting the police in the schools, I think all those are good ideas, but it's just not working in producing drugs, unfortunately.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A couple things. I'm hearing you say that counseling for people that are heading back out into a good situation, hopefully, is going to be the most effective way we can work. Is that true?
Well,
counseling them at the end of their term rather than
intervention at the end rather than in the beginning.
Would it be wise for us to be funneling more money onto the state, onto the counties where they have a 1-year term, no more, no less, and spending time in training and in intervening at that point rather than doing it all in the state system?
Well, I think you get a return on your dollar, but I also think you're still getting people into the state system, and of course you've got to deal with them as well. And of course, unfortunately, you're often getting the worst people into the state system, the people who are most right. worried about it. So it's not like you can ignore that group.
But
if coming out as well.
But if we're cutting down on the number of people that are going to...
That's right. Your front doors are cheaper than back door solutions.
Second question. What effect have any of the privately run facilities had in terms of recidivism? Are they any more effective than the public?
You mean private prisons?
Private prisons. or wings of prisons that are...
Yeah, wings are a little different because usually that's a contractor that comes in and, you know, they contract for some intervention and they're kind of managed. I see no real difference between those and state okay. units. Private prisons, on the other hand, there really haven't been any good studies of recidivism. I have assessed a number of private prison treatment facilities. And in my opinion, most of them are not the kind of program I would implement.
for the reasons you'd expect. It's a business.
And it's a way to save money.
Let me end with this, just so you know. I know there are always people that think, well, you know, we have these offenders to deal with, and locking them up is always a solution. I'm reminded of a story: a family was driving through Virginia in the fall, looking at all the leaves and the trees, and they saw this big house up on the hill, and it had a sign: Dr. Smith, veterinarian and taxidermist. And they thought that was kind of a funny combination, and when they got up closer underneath it said, either way, you get your dog back. I think we have to understand that if offenders you send, they go to prison or coming back into the community. And this is really a public safety issue. We want people coming back lower risk than what they went in. And so interventions, good interventions can help do that. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it. With that, we will adjourn the committee for the afternoon.